Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for all things Kings of War. Join your hosts Rob Fanoff and Mark Zielinski as they delve into the world of Mantica and bring you in-depth coverage of all things Kings of War.
Welcome to Countercharge, and tonight I am blessed to have Adam Ballard in the List Builder Studio. Adam, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great, Rob. Thanks for having me again.
Let's start with your credentials. You've been playing Kings of War for a little bit. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, I've been playing Kings of War for 2.5 years. So ever since Age of Sigmar came out, I made the switch. Was lucky enough to have a great group here in Omaha, where I'm from, that all unanimously decided to switch over from Warhammer to Kings of War. So I think we didn't lose a single player, and we actually, in fact, gained more players. So it was a really great adjustment for us.
You're lucky. A lot of people, a lot of splintering went on when the sundering happened.
Yes, I am well aware of certain regions that were not as lucky. So
what armies do you play?
I personally play undead and elves. I started in Warhammer, and I played vampire counts throughout my whole days of Warhammer, and I recently attained some elves, so I've been recently giving those guys a try.
Well, let's jump in. Let's talk about general list building principles. Let's start at the top. What draws you to an army? Is it the models? Is it how the army plays? Is it the rarity of the army, the perceived weakness or advantages of the army? What draws you to an army?
I think it's more of how an army plays, and specifically, I try to find hidden gems in armies. When I say that, I try to find specific units that maybe aren't used as widely. So, for instance, in a elf army, Drakon riders and dragons are kind of a staple for those types of armies. But I really have grown really fond of the Silverbreeze cavalry. They bought like a wood elf type army from Warhammer days, and really intrigued me. So that's kind of what I ran.
When you're building an army, do you consider like theme, like fluff or play style?
Yeah, definitely. So theme as far as fluff is a kind of a forethought in the front of my mind. I wouldn't say that I commit 100% to that, because if certain things that are fluffy just aren't playing well or aren't doing what I want on the tabletop, then by all means, I'm going to change it and maybe just change what I say the fluff is for that army. So it's a lot about what I want to get out of an army, as far as certain units have certain roles in my armies. So that's really what it comes down to, is are these units filling the roles that I want? And if not, I'll find something that will.
Where does the inspiration for a new project originate?
I think it originates with the excitement of playing certain armies. I'm a big fan of playtesting armies before buying any models. So I'll play with movement trays and pieces of cut-up cardboard, and I'll play an army for a week, maybe a couple months, until I actually find what I really want to play with, partially because I'm poor and I really want to make sure I buy the actual army I want to play with. But it really comes down to how the army plays on the tabletop, and that's what I get excited about.
So let's talk about chaff. How do you account for chaff in your list building? Is there a set number of units you want to include, or do you just consider like anti-chaff? How do you resolve chaff in your list building?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it really comes down to the role of the army. So like I said, I play two vastly different armies with elves and undead. And I find that my undead army normally has very few pieces of chaff. I normally run a couple of ghoul troops as my main chaff, but I try to make the units that I take hard enough to where if I'm not getting that first turn charge because I'm having to go through a chaff unit and then getting counter charge, I want to make sure those units are strong enough to withstand a punch and then counter charge. But in elves, for example, they are a finesse army more or less, and their defense and nerve just aren't what the undead are. So that type of an army, I feel like I need to incorporate more chaff to be able to get the first turn charge. Otherwise, I'm already on the back foot.
So when you're working on that list, you're getting everything together. How does the number of drops go into your thinking? Do you have like a sweet spot, a lot, a little, or how does the amount of drops affect your list building?
Personally, I think the more drops, the merrier. I don't think there's necessarily too many drops. It's usually kind of an afterthought once I get the core of the army that I want to play, and I need to have certain units to have the play style I want. Then I take a look and see how many drops do I have and how I can either get more drops or if I can sacrifice a few drops that I potentially would have taken to fulfill certain roles in the army that having more drops just won't help with.
Yeah, I know we've had a lot of people come in, and I think Rob can chime in, but I think, you know, 12 to 15 seems to be kind of the ballpark that a lot of people try to be in and around that amount.
Yeah, I would say most of my lists end up 13 or 14. That's the common one that I normally find myself. But I know that lists work with more, and I know they work with less, and it really depends on what it is that you're wanting to accomplish on the table.
So when you're looking at those lists and you're getting those drops together, are you thinking about combat groups? I know this is like the hot button controversial topic. Some people, you know, think about building their army in smaller components. Some people think of their army as one whole unit. So how does combat groups, does that enter your thinking? Speak a little bit to how are you designing an army? Are you designing it in smaller components, interchangeable pieces that work together? Or speak a little bit to that.
Yeah, definitely. So with the combat groups, my personal preference is I want to make an army that does not rely on combat groups to be certain groups that are together. I want to make an army that has the flexibility of any unit can potentially be a part of any combat group once it's deployed on the board. So I really want to have my army work fluidly all together before I break it down into combat groups. So that's more of a thought of combat groups once I hit the table and know what opponent I'm playing against.
That's interesting. So you're kind of thinking about what you want to have in your army as a whole, and then you're using the scenario or whatever kind of dictate then how you take that whole and divide it up into smaller components?
Yes. I deployment-wise and combat group-wise, I think I started playing elves the beginning of this year, so it's been about 6 months, and I can safely say that I've never deployed my elf army the same exact way in multiple different games. Therefore, I never had the same combat groups in multiple games.
I think that's really interesting because we've talked a lot about it, and we've talked about this on After Dark too, our painting thing on Friday nights, is that idea about how important it is to not be a slave to predetermined planning on how you want to have an idea of what you want to do, but that you don't necessarily, you want to be able to adapt when the actual situation is at hand. And I think that some of that combat group planning ahead of time can kind of force you into, if you think that the only way I can use these units are together, you might not be able to freely change your deployment strategies once the game's actually getting ready to start.
Right, and that's exactly what I try to avoid, is being handcuffed into a specific combat group or scenario that I know is a losing battle. I want to have the choice and the option with my army to play to the ultimate or the top tier that army can play at, and that's going to be making sure that every unit's flexible and can fill multiple roles depending on the scenario and depending on my opponent.
So how about inspiring? Do you have a set amount of inspiring choices you like to take? Are you taking inspiring choices with different speeds, knowing that this source is going to inspire? Like, my inspiring on a mount's always going to be near my calf. Or speak a little bit to how you think inspiring fits into your list building, and maybe some ideas or strategies when you're kind of deciding how you want to use inspiring.
Yeah, so I'm probably one of the few guys that'll say inspiring is not as relevant in my type of army, at least not the list that I'm currently playing with. Inspiring is a very important part of the game, but I feel that the way I'm playing my elf list is more of MSU style, to where they're over half my army does not need inspiring at any point in the game, because the units are so fragile that against most combat units, they're going to just fall over. So inspiring is essentially an afterthought of, do I want to make my opponent try and roll double ones twice or just once? That's for my current list that I'm saying. In other armies, that's not going to work, though. So it really depends on the playstyle. And I think my elf army is unique in the fact that I usually run two sources of inspiring at a 2,200 point list. And I've never found a situation where I wish I had more.
Yeah, I think if you bring up two kind of interesting ideas, is that idea of, again, inspiring, basing that on your specific army, like having the amount of inspiring choices may be different on the style of army that you're playing. And I really liked your idea of, is this inspiring source worth it to me when what it does is cause my opponent to a chance to roll double ones twice? That's an interesting idea, that in keeping something inspired that you know is probably going to take enough damage that it's not going to stick around, is it worth having an inspiring choice to try to force? You're basically forcing a snake eyes, or it's useless.
Yep, and that's what it normally comes down to. If my opponent rolls terribly on certain units, then maybe they need a 4 or 5. But again, I don't find myself ever wishing I had inspiring, because even with a 4 or 5 twice, the odds are against me.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Why don't you speak a little bit to how the organized playbook, has that affected your list building? Have you changed kind of the style of the lists you've been making since the organized playbook come out? Have you been playing with the organized playbook even in your casual games? Speak a little bit to that.
Yeah, so I really like the changes in the playbook. I really felt like the units that were changed were justifiable, and especially the magic items that were taken out and added were a really great addition to the game. I personally, like I said, I was starting elves earlier this year, so before I even knew this was coming out. And the army style that I wanted to play before this was really difficult. I found myself really struggling with defense 6 flying monsters, flying dragons, or regeneration dragons, or things of the like. And then after these changes, I found that the army that I was already playing with just shot up in the power curve. So I personally feel like I've benefited, or my army benefited very much from the changes, and I really had only a slight hit with the cover from breath attack. That's the only thing that really hindered my army. But as far as the scenarios and unit strength, those are kind of an afterthought for my list building. I felt like I really had a strong idea of how I wanted to play the list. And ever since playing it, I found that even with the new changes to unit strength and everything like that, my army is not going to have a whole lot of unit strength, but it does what it needs to do in order to win the game.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting, you bring up an interesting point about unit strength, where, you know, I think that you can plan for it, and then almost, I think, if you're designing an army to do a certain thing that works, or you're designing a balanced army, I wonder if unit strength just sort of takes care of itself.
Right, because I mean, I find that most of the time, unit strength only matters when the game's over. So if you have more unit strength than your opponent after the game, then the army's doing its job.
Speaking of dealing with different things and how Clash of Kings has changed things, are you still kind of taking into account strategies to deal with flying? Do you think some of the changes for flying specifically that came in Clash of Kings had made, brought them down to a little bit more of a of an even playing field? Or speak a little bit to, you know, since movement is so important in Kings of War, speak a little bit to how you think about dealing with flying units when you're list building?
Well, I think that to answer the first part of your question, I think that flyers and the changes they made to them were a perfect adjustment. I think before they were a little bit over the top and strong, but I'm really glad that the Rules Committee didn't decide to do some of the changes that were talked about on certain forums, because I felt like flyers would have gone from being one of the best things in the game to the worst thing in the game. And so I think it's a really great adjustment, just being disordered from receiving damage in combat. You can't fly. And then also the staple magic items that were on flying dragons have been removed and toned down. So I think flyers where they are right now are in a perfect spot where they're not overpowering. But obviously the name of the game is speed, I feel. And flying movement 10 is a really strong tool to have in the first place. To answer your second part, I strongly feel that every army, when in the list building stage, needs to consider how to deal with flyers. Because if you don't have an answer or have any actualized fighting or combating flyers, then you're already losing a game, I feel.
You know, I'm curious to hear your opinion, and also Rob can chime in here. I think the real issue with flyers was not their initial ability, because it makes sense. They have speed. They can outmaneuver. I think the real problem with flyers was, before the Clash of Kings pack, was their secondary charge. You could plan for a flyer's first charge, but then being able for those high two flyers to then just leave and go wherever they wanted, that's really when it became a very a real challenge to deal with.
Yeah, I agree, and that's why I was saying the making them disordered after receiving combat damage, so that way they can't fly after that, was a really great change, and I think really toned down the threats of a flyer's, as you said, their second charge.
Part of the change is wasn't necessarily for the high-end tournament player. It was the consideration for the new player. Because, you know, a few new players have been hit by that, where they show up at the game and they play and they're playing against like five flyers. And flyers are not necessarily the easiest thing to learn to play against. And, to Adam's point, by making them disordered, and actually, Jeremy, you made this point too, by making them disordered, you get more certainty of what they can do, right? So, okay, they have that initial charge. You can plan for that. And if you can disorder them, you can partially control what they're going to do. Right. It's, you know.
Right. And I completely agree. It's a really great strategy to have when combating flyers too, that I use certain pieces of chaff. And when I have them sitting on a flank that maybe a flyer's running down, and that flyer turns in to face the rest of my army and threaten them, they're not necessarily worried about that piece of chaff that, you know, only has a handful of attacks. But what I do is I normally just use that piece of chaff and charge the dragon that's coming at me. And if I get one wound through, that dragon's having to sit there for a turn, and that chaff did its job. I don't necessarily plan the rest of my army that I'll guarantee get a wound, but it's always a nice surprise when that happens and when you're essentially grounding a flyer for a turn.
Yeah, I think some unpredictability and some catching out of your opponent, I mean, that makes for a good strategy. I mean, not being able to picture a nimble charge or getting through with some surge shenanigans, I think that's okay. It's part of the strategy. But I think with flying especially, it just was so hard sometimes to predict especially like Rob said, for newer players, what flyers could do on their second and third charges. It just became to a point to where you couldn't even see it to try to plan against it.
Right, and flyer that's potentially going to just get to fly over the unit they were just in combat with, there's sometimes you can see it, and sometimes you just couldn't do anything about it because you couldn't protect your flank, or maybe you had a unit in the front that you couldn't just expose yourself to. So I strongly agree that's probably the best resolution they could have had to tone down the flyers to the point where they're still very useful, but they don't have that secondary use that they used to.
Why don't you speak a little bit to your philosophy on magical artifacts? You know, we've heard a lot about players who consider certain artifacts almost essential for unit choices. Like, I'm not going to take this unit unless I can give them this artifact. Some people have talked a little bit about in the studio about taking artifacts when they have a few extra points left over. Why don't you speak a little bit to kind of your thinking on how you look at artifacts in your list building?
Well, with artifacts, I'm kind of middle of the road with this. I feel like there are certain units that I already add the artifact points when I'm creating the list. And then I normally get to the point where my list is created and maybe I have, 30 or 40 extra points. And then I look at, okay, what unit can benefit from certain artifacts? And those are afterthoughts. But if I want a unit to fill a specific role, it has to have this artifact to fill that role. It's already in the army before I finish it.
So why don't you talk a little bit about, okay, so you're building your list, right? You've thought about drops, you've thought about inspiring, you've thought about artifacts, you're kind of checking these boxes as you go. Speak a little bit to how do scenarios enter your mind when you're list building? Are you kind of trying to imagine how a list you're working on is going to work in a objective scenario? How is it going to work in a movement or a loot token-based scenario? Speak a little bit to your thoughts and philosophies on how do scenarios enter into your thinking when you're working on a new list.
Well, with scenarios, I guess I still kind of have a Warhammer mentality. I usually involve the destruction of my opponent's army. So I find that scenarios are somewhat of an afterthought to my list building aspect, where I realize that, after playtesting that, okay, so this army does struggle in this particular scenario, but in every scenario we play, we do end in combat and we do have shooting. So I try to focus on the aspect of if I can win the first three or first four turns and then spend the last few turns concentrating on the scenario, then that makes that army much easier for me to play, at least.
Yeah, I think that's another kind of interesting idea, which is, front loading your killing agenda. And then, it's like, okay, I'm going to focus on beating my opponent in these key, interactions in the early part of the game, knowing that if I can do that effectively and I've made good trades and I have these elements of ability in my army, I can then work on maybe the second half of the game, focus more on, keeping your eye on the objectives or scenarios, whatever you're playing.
Exactly. And I always add that key element, as you said, of mobility, and you hit it right on the spot for saying that, it's all about trades. So if I get the matchups I want and I get the trades I want, then, those loot tokens are going to be so much easier for me to grab when my opponent only has a couple things left by the end of the game.
So you spoke a little bit about it before. But I'm curious to hear a little bit more about your ideas on pre-deployment. I know some people like to have a sort of idea of strategies on what they want to do. And I know you mentioned earlier that very rarely do you deploy the same way every time. So if you don't have kind of a strong pre-deployment plan, just do you have any philosophies or thoughts or what's going through your mind when you're getting ready to deploy? Are you being completely reactive to your opponent? Are you looking to try to get some different speed advantages? Or speak a little bit to kind of what's going through your head when you're building a list, when you're thinking about how you're going to maybe want to deploy that list.
Well, I think the main thing for my list building and deployment is I normally have first few sets of drops. They're normally the chaff type things that are put out just to get a sense of what my opponent's doing. And then from there going forward, it's a completely reactive situation and it's completely matchup based. So I know that unit A is going to be able to take out my opponent's unit B. So I need to get that matchup. I need that to be set up across the board. And that's where it comes into, I don't want to have certain deployments required for my units. So, and I think the way I take inspiring into account, it really helps me, because if I need my dragon to match up against a specific enemy unit and they deploy it on the ops flank or the rest of my army was deployed, that's fine by me. I deploy my lone inspire on them, knowing that that's a matchup that I can win and I'm going to take advantage of that.
Well, let's talk about terrain. Specifically, do you account for the types of terrain you're going to see on the table?
Most definitely. This is not Warhammer anymore. Terrain actually matters. So I know that most tournaments are going to the kind of standard terrain where there's 8 to 10 pieces on average. You can almost guarantee there's going to be a few hills that probably aren't in deployment zones anymore. Impassable terrain, obstacles, and then area terrain or forests. So my list building, I need to make sure that I have something with Pathfinder that can get in combat with, without being hindered. I need to make sure that I can utilize other pieces of terrain to effectiveness in order to still obtain the goal of my army and whatever my game plan would be.
Let's talk about hobby. How does that affect your list building?
Well, that's a good question. I am not as big of a hobby person as I wish I was. I'm very much a tabletop gamer first, and I got to get this painted for that tournament second. So, I find enjoyment in certain painting of certain models, but it really is difficult for me to sit down and really spend a long period of time on a project like that. So I love the aesthetics and look of specific models, and if I like them, I'm going to buy them and I'm going to put them in the army. But the aspect of actually painting them and getting them tournament ready is one that I personally struggle with.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. You're a gamer first, hobby is second.
Right. So I'm sure there's others out there, but I know that part of the game and part of the tournaments are your painting scores, and I'll be the first to say that my painting scores are usually subpar. So
opportunity. That's just an opportunity.
That's right.
Yeah, and I wonder. I've always thought about maybe that the hobbyist would have a harder time with, they've painted a unit, they love it, and maybe it's not so good in the game, but they still want to use it because they've spent all these all these hours in the painting and they love it so much. But I think probably the more gamer runs into that same thing when, if they're really not in the painting, they're like, well, geez, I've spent all this time painting this unit, I don't want to paint something else. So I mean, but I understand the kind of the dilemma that I bet you that dilemma of when you choose or not choose to use a painted unit is probably felt by both hobby gamers and more, power or...
You know what I think, though, Jeremy? I think that the gamer is never even going to paint stuff that's not going to be used. I think they're playing with, you alluded to it earlier, Adam.
Yeah, good point.
You're using cardboard bases or whatever. You're playtesting before you even get to the hobby. You already know what's in that list.
That's exactly right, because as Jeremy said, I think it hasn't really happened yet, but I think if it came to the point of I figured out a list I wanted to play, I painted it all up, and then later down the road I realized, oh man, I wish I could just substitute this unit out for that unit. For me, it's most likely not going to happen. By that time, I'm committed to the army. If it's painted, even if there's a more optimal unit, it's going to be really difficult for me to say, well, that unit that I spent, X amount of hours on painting and getting ready, it's just going to sit on the shelf from here out.
Well, let's jump in now, Adam, and talk about your specific list. Now, the one you're going to share with us is the one that you actually took to You're taking the Lady of the Lake, is that right?
That's right. And this list is very similar to the one I took to Bug Eater as well. Bug Eater was only 50 points more, so there was a few extra magic items tossed into it.
Well, why don't you start at the top? Why don't you take us through the army list, unit by unit? As you're going through, you know, share with us what's the role for each unit. And, you know, we talked about combat groups. If you've got like interchangeable sections of the army, kind of hit on that as well.
Yeah, definitely. So to start off, I got a horde of kindred archers with the Heartseeker chant. Their role is kind of the anchor to my army. They're the slowest moving thing in my army. So they need to be deployed in the proper area. Otherwise, they're really kind of out of place for the whole game. Next, I have 5 troops of Silver Breeze Cavalry. And these are really what I built the army around. As I said before, I really like the idea of a MSU, kind of a hit-and-run type army. I really liked how Wood Elves played in Warhammer Fantasy. So I found this unit and I said, why doesn't anybody play this in the elf army that I had seen? And I don't even think I went overboard. I think 5 troops of them is a pretty strong number for me. So next I got Stormwind Cavalry Regiment with the Potion of the Caterpillar. That again was one of the magic items that's included with the unit. Otherwise the unit's not in the army. So they're heavy cavalry. They're speed 9 heavy cav, so they're really great for this type of army to reach out and punch something. Next, I got Drakon Riders Horde with Brew of Strength. These guys, I mean, what's to say? They're Drakon Riders. They're a huge threat, and that's essentially what they're meant to be, is a threat to where if an opponent comes close enough, they're either going to take my shooting or they're going to get charged. And then I have 3 Dragon's Breath in the army. And when I found the Silver Breeze Cavalry, I then also kept looking and I found the Dragon's Breath. And I noticed that people more often than not at the time were taking Bolt Throwers. And I thought 15 elite breath attacks, essentially with an 18-inch threat, movement 6 and 12-inch range, was too good to pass up. So I've put 3 of those into my army, and they're so cheap, 90 points. They're essentially my chaff, my throwaway units too. And then I have Army Standard Bearer with Diadem of Dragonkind. So essentially another mini Dragon Breath. And then I added a Dragon Lord with just Bear. And, you know, what's to say? It's a Dragon Lord. Adds inspiring, adds a really hard punch with 10 attacks, crushing 3.
Solid list.
I enjoy it. It's a hell of a lot of fun to play. Much different than the undead that I'm used to.
Yeah, there's a couple things I in looking at your list that it's like you like traveled into my brain while I was sleeping, because this is like the list, the elf list that I've been dreaming of the past couple months as I've been getting ready to do. I have like an elf project in the wings. And a lot of this stuff I really like. Like, I think the Silver Breeze are a cavalry. You know, they're expensive. They're not like your 100-point throwaway chaff, but their speed and mobility and the able to basically redeploy at any time and still hit on 4s, I think is so powerful with elite that even though they have 7 attacks, the fact that they're always hitting on 4s no matter how you move them for the most part with elite, I think makes their shooting really reliable to get a couple points of damage.
Yep. And I mean, as you say, a couple points of damage, but when you have 3, 4, 5 units of them shooting at the same unit, that couple points of damage adds up to more than what an archer horde can put out. And as you said, they are expensive, but they fill so many more roles than just shooting that I'll never leave an elf list without them.
Did this list, you know, develop? I know you've only been playing for like 6 months with the elves, but have you developed into this list? Is this the culmination of, you know, months of practice and play, or is this just the first iteration?
Oh, no, this is definitely a development. So As I said before, I went to Masters. I actually took Elves to Masters, and I borrowed a friend's army to do so. I took a similar style of list where I had 4 troops of Silver Breeze, 3 Dragon Breath, but I didn't have as much of the other punch that I found I needed. So I had 2 regiments of cavalry and 2 regiments of Palace Guard. And then a regiment of archers. So that list was more of a true MSU, I guess. But I found that I need to have certain units that pack a punch. My shooting is not going to win the game for me. So that's where the Drakon Riders came in and the dragon. So it still kept the main core of the Silver Breeze, the Dragon's Breath, and the just the really fast type of army, and the I'm going to be able to threaten you without you being able to threaten me for however many turns before I have to deal with units.
So what was it about the elves that drew you to wanting to play this army specifically? Have you played elves in other games? Was there something about the army that kind of stood up to you, or speak a little bit about to kind of what drew you to picking this this faction?
Well, it kind of started back in Warhammer. So as I've alluded to before with wood elves, that at the end of Warhammer, that's when I actually acquired most of the units that I'm using for this army. I wanted to start Wood Elves because I thought their play style was just so intriguing. And I was growing tired of the same undead or vampire count army that just kept moving, units forward. And it was basically like, well, if you're strong enough to kill me, then you are. Otherwise, I'm going to kill you. So I really wanted a finesse army and a challenge. And I think this army is perfect because if I make, for example, I made one mistake in my final game at Bug Eater, and I was versing Travis Tim, and the one mistake I made ended up just catastrophically swinging into his favor. And it was just a domino effect that if this army makes a mistake and somebody makes me pay for it, I've pretty much thrown the game away at that point.
So kind of let's explore that a little bit. So what when you're playing this army, what do you struggle with? Are there specific things that if you mishandle the finesse of it a little bit, you get punished? Do you find in playing your games, is there specific things this army struggles with?
Yes. So, just to kind of, give all my opponents that I may or may not be seeing at Lady of the Lake the advantage, it really struggles against, difficult, individuals to kill. Again, that was another really big benefit for me when vampires went from defense 6 to defense 5. This list really struggles with those characters, and most undead lists have those characters in them. And sadly enough, I've played 4 undead players since I've started elves, and I am 0-4 against undead. So it must be a sign.
So I can imagine, I'm trying to kind of visualize what you're talking about. I can imagine in dealing with a chip shooting sort of army where you're trying to ping damage from a lot of units, that going up against that defense 6 -1 to hit in individuals anyway would be very tough to try to put any real damage on them with those Silver Breeze cav.
Yes, and at that point it's basically a game of I have to ignore them and let them do whatever they want, unless they make a mistake and sit them in front of a Drakon unit or dragon, and then I might be able to punish them for that. But the shooting aspect is not going to take out a character, and it's not meant to do that. So I really have to prioritize my targets, and a defense 6 individual is not anywhere close to the highest priority.
So we kind of explored a little bit of some of the challenges, but when this army's doing really well, what does it do well? What's happening when everything's firing on all cylinders? Speak a little bit to kind of what you run into when you're getting some real success with this list. What's going on?
Well, normally when I'm getting success with this list, it's I kind of feel bad for certain armies I play against and certain opponents because I've had games where this list just I have godly shooting and my opponent's army just doesn't have enough speed to keep up to where by the bottom of turn three, I've already won the game and they maybe have a couple units left. So it is a very powerful shooting, but it also packs such a huge punch in combat when it's necessary that I can dictate the combats that I want, and the ones that I don't want, I can either just shoot them or I can avoid them altogether, and I have enough units to chaff them up or just to dance around that I can essentially dictate every single combat that I want in that game.
So you mentioned it earlier when you're kind of thinking about predetermined strategies for deployment or combat. Looking specifically at this list, you mentioned beforehand that you usually like to throw out a couple things first and kind of see what your opponent does. Is that usually your Silver Breeze Cav, or speak a little bit kind of to kind of your ideas of your first few deployment moves specifically with this list?
Yeah, so normally my Silver Breeze Cav, I deploy either three or four of those just across the front line. Because they are so fast and nimble, they can always redeploy if necessary. And then it also just hides absolutely not my opponent has absolutely no clue where my actual units are going to be. Because if they're spending time chasing Silver Breeze, they're probably already losing that battle.
Yeah, I just really, I think when we had Chris Kapsner on before, he was talking a lot about visualizing deployment, of actually putting the units on the table so you know how units can work. Because sometimes a unit could be half an inch too far to the left, which causes you to pivot to move around it, and you can really create traffic jams for yourself. And I think that's one thing I love about that Silver Breeze Cav, being speed 10 and nimble. Like you said, you can deploy it, but you really have a lot of power in moving them, based on what the scenario, battle is dictating.
Right. And I mean, the Silver Breeze are, like I said, the staple of this army. This army wouldn't exist without them. We can talk about them all day, but I think the best thing to do is see how they actually play on the field. And I catch a lot of people off guard. They just don't know the power of the Silver Breeze, and they, kind of look at them and, point out their, weaknesses, which I think their biggest weakness was how many points they cost. But that's something where the points only matter if my opponent can kill it, and Silver Breeze are one of those things that most armies can't kill.
So for your Dragon Breath, and these are interesting units. I haven't really seen these played that much in my meta, so I think, they might be kind of a neglected unit. But you spoke to the fact that you sometimes use them for chaff. So will you just kind of run them forward, or are you trying to hide them behind other things, or are you putting them in a position where it's one, either you're going to get shot by them, which is good for me, or two, you got to use a unit to kill them, which that unit's not then doing something else, which is also good for me.
Yeah, so the Dragon's Breath really play a key role. They, I know I said I normally don't do battle groups, but the Dragon's Breath are all three, essentially one unit as I look at them. They all three sit together because the combined force of their 45 breath, elite breath attack can eliminate a unit. So the way how I use them is normally they face down whatever infantry units are coming at me. Their threat range is an 18-inch range with the move 6 and 12 breath. So if I'm versing an opponent that has speed 6 or lower, my Dragon's Breath are actually getting two rounds of shooting before the opponent actually can charge and get into combat. And 90 breath shots, it's going to kill pretty much any unit in the game. So it's a really finesse as well, because as I said, movement six or lower. So in movement six, I just match it up to where I can hit the corner or their edge of the base. Center points of their unit is not within 12 inches of me, so that way I can shoot them, but they can't shoot me.
Yeah, it's that really, you know, that idea on how, and I think this is a pretty interesting topic for experienced players, but especially for new players, is the difference between range and effective range, right? Like, yep. Unit may only move six and shoots 12. It's good to kind of, as you're beginning to get better, get more into it and develop deeper strategies, is you can start thinking of, well, what's this unit's effective range? So in actuality, this weapon may have an 18-inch range because the unit can move six before firing 12 inches.
Yep, exactly. So the effective range is 18 inches, which, you know, is the second best in my army, essentially, outside of the other shooting. You know, speed 10, the effective range of 20 for combat, speed 9 cavalry, they're effectively an 18-inch threat range, too. So the Dragon's Breath keeps up with the rest of the army in that aspect.
Now, I'm guessing that I think I may know the answer to this question, but I think it's good for us to explore it anyway. Speak a little bit to what are this army's like best performers. Is it really the Dragon Breath and Silver Breeze? Are those kind of like, when those things are working, you're off to a pretty good start?
Yeah, so those, my Dragon's Breath, they normally don't actually do anything first turn or two unless my opponent is really pushing up the field strongly, which I feel like is probably one of the better options, depending on, you know, if I'm versing an all melee army. But I would have to agree that my favorites, at least, are the Dragon's Breath and the Silver Breeze Cavalry. And I know you normally ask what one specific unit is, you know, your favorite in the army. And I can't pick one specific unit. I would have to say it's the it's those units as a whole and how the role they fill in this type of army.
And that's okay. You know, you can love a lot of things here on Countercharge. We're accepting of all units. Soon you're going to be able to take some of those bulwarkers, right, in your dwarf army, Rob?
Absolutely, and they even got crushing strength.
Boost for the dwarves, well needed.
So you talked a little bit about your best performers. You've talked about kind of how you view the army and it kind of should operate in a vacuum. Why don't you speak a little bit to this army specifically in regards to scenarios? Are there a certain type of scenarios that you feel, yes, okay, I'm good? Are there certain scenarios that you're like, you struggle with this scenario? Is it dependent on what you're fighting? Or speak a little bit to how this army works in the different sort of archetypes of scenarios.
Well, I think this list is probably one of the strongest lists I've found for scenario aspect, because, as you said there, I mean, really in the list building aspect, you have to be diverse and be able to concentrate on those scenarios when necessary. I don't really find a specific scenario that this army struggles with because it has so much speed. And it has so much power in the shooting as well as the combat. If I had to pick one specific one, I would say maybe Dominate. But even then, it really depends on the opposing army that I'm versing. But normally, if my opponent has to move, especially if they have to move towards me, that's something that I'm already, you know, that my army's going to eat that up. So I would say that scenario-wise, it is just well-rounded, strong, and it can handle any type of scenario that's thrown at it.
I wonder, in looking at this, one kind of scenario that pops into my head is Eliminate. You know, in an Eliminate, for, you know, you get the tokens to give to your strongest units or your highest point value units. And at the end of the game, you get a point for each token you still have. And then you get 2 points for tokens that you got from an enemy unit that you killed in melee. So I'm wondering, have you played that scenario with this list? I'm just wondering, with how much shooting you have, I could see it maybe being a challenge to kill what you want to kill with shooting, but then if you're trying to get those tokens, kill those units in close combat? Or have you had much experience with that specific scenario yet?
I've probably only played about one game of that, and the game that I did play, I remember I was going up against a almost all infantry melee army, so it's something where with that type of a scenario, my game plan may just change slightly. I have plenty of punch in this army where those Drakon Riders, those Stormwind Cavalry, that dragon, it can take out whatever I want in combat, and I can then just fire on the rest of the army, and then even make it to where if I choose to charge a specific unit, I have my Silver Breeze set up to where if I don't get countercharged from a flank, or I throw a Dragon Breath right in front of a unit to where it can't physically get around me to hit the combat units that I have.
So as far, we've talked a little bit about scenarios, but what about army matchups? Are there, and you mentioned it briefly with like pre-Clash of Kings, undead hero lists, but are there any other like popular list builds that you've faced against that you maybe are a little rock, paper, scissors with this list? Have you run into any of that?
Well, there are, I mean, no army is perfect. So I feel like the, some of the more difficult lists, and I haven't been able to play against all of them, but I know that the more difficult lists to play against are, I played Mike Rosowski at Bug Eater, and his Empire Dust Army is defense 5 across the board. Half of it is regeneration, and then he has a stupid amount of heal pumped out from the rest of his casters. So that type of an army does pose a more difficult challenge for my army. But even with that uphill battle and that difficult challenge, it still is just, I feel, an even matchup at that point. We, in fact, just ended up drawing. But he had a really unique style army. So I think the high defense, high healing, and I would say combat individuals that also have a good amount of defense or regeneration are the ones that are most difficult for this type of army.
Yeah, I think what your list speaks to, though, which I think is, again, you know, one of the interesting things we've been seeing in List Builder Studio is that there are so many different variations of builds you can have that can be successful. Like, you know, this is a little different from what, you know, you would think of as, you know, a traditional, you know, elf build, you know, but it shows you the strength of the game and the fact that you can be creative. You can, you know, think outside the box or try different things or, you know, and have success with it. You're not like shackled into playing elves. If you got to play elves, you got to play them only one way or you're doing it wrong.
Right. And that's also something I look for in an army is versatility, because, you know, elves, I really enjoy and love the way I'm playing the elves right now. But who's to say, you know, maybe 6 months from now, a year from now, that either there's a new book out or maybe I just, you know, evolved this list. And
yeah, you know, Kevin, one of the guys who does our After Dark painting Google Hangouts, he plays undead, which is my main army, but we play two completely different styles of undead. And, you know, they're both effective in their own way. And I think it's like cool to when you get into a faction to not necessarily feel like you have to play it one way. You can play it whatever way, like that you've spoken to earlier, the way that army appeals to you and appeals to your playing style. That, you know, maybe not every army can do everything, but at least you do. There is some ability to play different styles.
Right, and I think that Mantic's done a great job of keeping the options open for armies, and being an undead player myself, I think undead is the key staple where that army can play just about any way you want, and I think the ways the army can't play is why I'm playing elves.
So, Adam, I know you're mainly a competitive wargamer. that's cool. But you know, do you play this at the local game shop? And how is it? How does this list perform when it's not in the uber competitive environment?
Well, I do play it every once in a while at my local game shop, mostly when I'm preparing for a tournament, so the month or the week or two before. But this type of an army, I really feel bad, and I feel like I'm cheating some of the not as competitive players out of certain games. Because there, like I said, there's games where my opponent just says, you know, top, bottom of turn three, they say, you know, you mind if we just, you know, re-rack and maybe you play your undead instead? Because there's times where halfway through the game, my opponent has two units left, and that's how this army can perform. It can swing one way drastically, especially if I'm playing, you know, maybe somebody who's not doesn't have a tournament competitive list, but it can feel like you're almost taking a game out of your opponent's hands when, you know, it's all me. I'm going to shoot. I'm going to charge. And, oh, look, all your units died. So I feel bad. So I do take my undead, and I do play with some more fluffy elf lists in a more casual environment.
Now, in terms of this list, do you have anything in the back of your mind, some variations to the list that you want to try out?
Yes, I do. So I know we talked about the list strengths and everything, but one of the things that I actually am very on the fence about is, surprisingly, I think the Archer Horde is my weakest unit in the whole army. And I mean, for 280 points with Arch Secret Champ, I really felt like they would pack just huge punch in the shooting phase that I wouldn't be able to get with everything else. And that's, you know, they're 20 shots with piercing one against, you know, normal defense four units that maybe it's just my dice with them, but I'm, you know, plucking off four or five wounds. And I'm like, man, I really feel like I should be doing like 8-10 wounds to that archer unit might eventually fade from the list. And I already have kind of an idea of a replacement. I really like the looks of the elven chariots, so those might see some play in the near future.
How about hobby? You got any interesting ideas for the army in terms of hobby?
Yeah, so I'm actually getting this army ready for the Lady of the Lake GT because I broke down and borrowed an army again for the Bug Eater. So the army that I'm getting ready, I do have some really cool things and cool themes that I'm going off of. I'm really focusing in on the wood elf feel. So I actually have modeled and made my own trees that I'm putting on the multi base, and I flocked them myself. And I think they turned out really cool. They look like really fantasy trees that have like really twisting bark. So I'm really excited about that. I still need to get the models themselves painted. But, you know, a month and a half away, I should hopefully be able to. And I do have a loving wife, Stacia, that's a really good painter too. So she ends up helping me every once in a while. So
you're blessed. You're living the dream.
Yeah. Yes. Both you guys got these great hobby wives. I can hear Mark just like crying softly in the background.
I'm lucky enough to have her. It's just, you know, I have to make sure that she gets everything else she wants that when she's painting models. So
in terms of hobby for this army, you know, how have you gone about modeling and painting the army? Like what models did you use? Just talked about how you hobbied this army up.
Yeah, so I have, like I said, a lot of GW elves. When I was still playing Warhammer, I wanted to play the Wood Elf list. So I have most of my models are GW. So for keeping the theme of the Wood Elf list, all my Silverbreeze Cav are the Glade Riders for Wood Elves. My Archers are the Glade Archers. Even my Stormwind Cavalry, I'm modeling as the Wild Guard from the Wood Elf book. So, and then for the rest of the army, it kind of took a turn towards high elves because of the model types. So Drakon riders, I would have liked to have the Dragonhawk riders, but I ended up actually finding quite a few of my local players wanting to offload some of the Isle of Blood Griffin model for the high elves. So I found enough of those to make a unit of Drakon riders out of that. And then I have a what's his name? I have a BSB from the high elves as well. And then for the dragon, I actually won a Mantic dragon. How it turned out, I got Bones miniatures. I got three different styles of their baby dragons, and it ended up costing me like $12 with shipping to get those. And those were the first things that I actually painted up.
Adam, it's been a long evening. Are you ready to wrap this up with 10 questions in rapid succession?
I think I could do that, yeah.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hit you a question. Just give me your answer. Whatever pops in your mind, right off the tongue. You ready to roll?
Ready.
What's your favorite army?
I'd have to say undead.
What is your least favorite scenario?
Pillage.
What drives you creatively or competitively?
Competitively, the army styles, how they play. That's how I get my inspiration.
When your opponent rolls snake eyes,
I feel really bad for him, but I know that he's going to get it back from me. So
when you roll snake eyes,
and there you go. I just gave you the gift back. So that's usually how it is.
What's your favorite hobby material?
Spray paint.
What is your biggest gaming pet peeve?
Improper movement.
If you had to replace miniature wargaming with another hobby, what would it be?
Probably World War II gaming of some sort.
What other miniature war game would you not want to play?
Age of Sigmar.
If you had a romantic evening with Ronnie Renton, what would you whisper sweetly to him?
Probably should have looked up more on Ronnie Renton. That's probably what I'd whisper to him.
Hey, Adam, we appreciate you coming on and chatting to us about elves and list building. And it was another great time, Jeremy.
Yeah, good stuff. Very good stuff. I like his list, you know, fast, punch you in the face. You know, it really speaks to just how many different styles of hobbyists and how many different types of gamers we have in the community. You know, everyone has these different good ideas. So it's been really cool to kind of for us to and the audience to get exposed to all these different ideas.
I appreciate you giving me on. I know that not everybody gets invited to do the list building, so I feel blessed to be a part of it.
That's good words to take us out. And until
thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Countercharge. Please let us know what you thought of the show by emailing us at counterchargepodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at countercharge15, or by posting on our episode thread on the discussion forum found on manticgames.com. If you enjoy the show, you can help others find out about it by leaving positive reviews on iTunes. Until next time, keep countercharging. Music is a composition of Kevin MacLeod and is licensed under Creative Commons.